Ned Cole at the piano opening up this afternoon's Fresh Air with a recording of Moonlight in Vermont. Many observers of the political scene assume that civil rights activist Reverend Jesse Jackson is interested in running for the presidency. Today at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., Jackson discussed the viability of a black presidential candidate. We'll hear his press club address and the question and answer period which followed this afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock. With me now on Fresh Air is Malcolm Forbes, the owner, chairman, and editor-in-chief of Forbes magazine, one of America's top three business magazines, whose slogan is Forbes, the capitalist tool. According to the latest Forbes survey, one out of five Forbes readers is a millionaire. Forbes magazine was founded by my guest's father. Malcolm Forbes joined the staff of his father's publication in 1947 and was elected editor and publisher of the magazine in 1954 after his father's death. Forbes remains a family business. Malcolm Forbes' son, Malcolm Forbes Jr., is president and deputy editor-in-chief, and his son, Christopher, is vice president and associate publisher. Malcolm Forbes has a reputation in the business world for being extravagant and unpredictable. One of his hobbies is hot air ballooning. In 1973, he was the first person to fly across America coast to coast in a hot air balloon. Forbes is also a motorcycling enthusiast, an art collector, and a collector of toy soldiers. Malcolm Forbes is a very wealthy man, although he never publicly states how wealthy. His fortune has been estimated at about $200 million. Malcolm Forbes is in Philadelphia to speak tonight at a World Affairs Council dinner. The program will begin at 6 o'clock at the Bellevue Stratford. And for more information, you can call the World Affairs Council at 563-5363. That's 563-5363. Malcolm Forbes, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air. And let me ask you to describe the editorial philosophy of Forbes.
Well, excuse me. Our philosophy is very simple. We think the capitalist system, free enterprise, works, but it's the biggest menace to it is not critics of it. It's those who fail in it, those who run businesses unsuccessfully. So our job in Forbes is to critique, if you will, corporate performance from the point of view of customers, from the point of view of stockholders, from the point of view of those who own or are dependent on the company. We find that measuring the man with the steering wheel, the intangibles as to whether he's capable or not, that's a tough thing, but it's the essence of it. A balance sheet is history. People think that something like General Motors or General Electric, they think they're abstractions. They're not. They're the man that's head of the company. So our job every issue is to try to evaluate how they're doing.
So that's why there's an emphasis on feature stories on the men who run the corporations.
Absolutely.
Who's your targeted audience?
They're the people who either run businesses, own their own, or want to. It's the world of the businessman.
How would you compare Forbes with its two major competitors, Fortune and Business Week?
Favorably. I think we're Business Week does sort of feel as a weekly that they have to cover all the developments of the week. We don't. If it's just it isn't the news, we try to evaluate what's happened between issues, two companies, and over a longer span. So we are less current news conscious than Business Week. On the other hand, Fortune, before it started falling behind us and changes its frequency from monthly to bimonthly as we are, they used to do the corporate study both in-depth and some people would say ad infinitum. We were less kind. We'd say ad nauseum. But the fact is that they had a different approach. Now they are trending toward our approach. They're trying to make their articles shorter, but it's very hard to retread if you're used to doing something in volume. It's very hard to learn to write briefly, succinctly, and get to the point.
The slogan of Forbes is Forbes, the capitalist tool. How did who came up with that slogan, and why have you decided to go with it?
It was many years ago. I would like to claim credit, but the only credit I can claim is a quick recognition of that as being a challenging and pithy summary, because 15 years ago, it's less so today, capitalist was sort of a word that had come into disrepute as a result of the recession, as a result of communist ideology and socialist conviction. I mean, capitalist was supposed to epitomize some big fat guy with his sitting on his money bags while people toiled and starved and died and were jailed or beaten up. You know, the word had come to be, everybody denied they were a capitalist. They preferred free enterprise and other words. But you have no free enterprise if you don't have a nest egg. It's called capital. And so it was suggested by our agency, and I think more in humor than seriousness, but we latched on to it and have plugged it ever since, and I think rightly so. And again, people, they now are aware of the virtues. It's not a swear word anymore. To call somebody a capitalist isn't to call them a bad name.
So you think capitalism has a better image than it did a few years ago?
Yes.
What do you think the image is now?
I think it is very favorable, because you see what's happening in places such as Russia and China. You recall Khrushchev's famous remark that communism was going to, his children would live to see it bury capitalism. But what you have there now is they're both suffering, all those systems, what I call creeping capitalism, because they find that it's a fancy word. But all it means is that if you can keep a little of what you earn, you have a freedom of choice as to where you work, if you can get work, etc. But it's an incentive system. And Russia, as everybody knows and is oft said, and it's true, I think something like 85 to 90% of the vegetables available in Moscow are grown on those 1% of the plots allowed to be privately owned rather than in the communes. If people are motivated, if they can get to keep a piece of the action, they're into it. And in Russia, in China, where we motorcycled recently, my son and I and some friends, we found they made a big point of the fact that since the 10-year counter-revolution bit, that now there are very few communes left. They're getting more productivity by going back to where people feel responsible for their own plot rather than a pooled effort. So my feeling is that capitalism has been rehabilitated not only by the failure of alternatives, but with all the failures of the capitalist system, such as widespread unemployment on occasion and other obvious inequities, that of the systems, it is the best functioning with all its flaws.
As one of the great winners within the system, what responsibility do you think that you and other wealthy people who live in a capitalist free enterprise system like America have to people who have been losing within the system, who are unemployed or working poor?
Well, I don't think you should approach it from the idea of you have a benign or philanthropic obligation. I think anybody that runs a successful business, establishes one, the multiplicity of new millionaires that are offshoots of the computer age and software and high tech, they are fulfilling the function by creating new jobs, new enterprises. They don't do it to be philanthropic. You should be in the church for that. You should be in social work if your motives are totally eleemosynary, totally charitable, totally selfless. That isn't what makes people successful in a monetary sense. That isn't what builds a business. People who build businesses, create jobs, pioneer new products, make something better that costs less, they are performing to the maximum in terms of making capitalism function. fine when they've made it and when they have a lot of it. Then you do, if you've got any sense of conscience or decency or just simply nothing else to do, you do as, for instance, the Rockefellers for two generations have done. They've concentrated on the intelligent dispersion of a great fortune. They've succeeded in dispersing it onto the fourth generation. They're not Rockefeller rich, but the present generation, of which there are just two of the five in the family left alive, they've done a magnificent job. But philanthropy is a byproduct. The one who contributes, in the sense you asked the question, I think, the one who contributes the most is the one that, in his getting, creates jobs, products, all the things that go with the building of a business.
Do you believe in like a full employment policy or national health insurance?
Oh, national health insurance, I think, to put take the last part of your question first, I think that the fact that people who have lost their jobs in this great transition we're undergoing, and not all of them are a direct result of the recession, but those people, when they lose the benefits of Blue Cross, Blue Shield, medical benefits, that if they are ill, and let's face it, somebody who's conscientious, who's lost their job, they're more susceptible to illness simply because they're mentally depressed. They'd be scratching and feeling frustrated. The fact that they have no coverage is absolutely wrong. And the administration's proposal, national health is not going to be efficient. It doesn't work well in Britain. But there has to be the so-called safety net, a fail-safe. And the administration has proposed something be worked out where companies that let employees go, that for a considerable period they're carried on their plan, and for such cost as is to the company, they would have some tax adjustment because it isn't related to a normal business expense. But there has to be. That is a responsibility that must be met, because these people, unemployed, had a security that they cease to have the moment they lose their job. That's an inequity. That's a wrong. As for believing in full employment, I think it'd be lovely if everybody was employed. But to create a system that guarantees full employment, you have what you have in Russia and China, and it isn't even working there now. You have, when somebody has the guarantee, then the motive is gone, the incentive is gone. What it does is level all jobs. You're assigned to a work where hands are needed. There isn't the spark. There isn't the what we have as a counterpart to full employment is much better. We have unemployment insurance. We have other things. But to say to everybody, we as a government will guarantee everybody a job, would change the whole nature of what's built this country in the sense of its entrepreneurial thriving. It just simply doesn't work. It would be at the expense of people who have jobs and at the expense of incentive, and it wouldn't accomplish the mission, in my opinion, that the good intention has in saying full employment. It's like being for motherhood or against it. Who's against it?
Malcolm Forbes is my guest, if you're just joining us, the chairman and editor-in-chief of Forbes magazine. Critics of our current system would say that the high rate of unemployment is a sign that our economy isn't working and that there's a failure somewhere at the heart of the system. How would you respond?
I would say that's absolutely an erroneous analysis. There isn't failure at the heart of the system. What people have forgotten, we've been through and into, we're now climbing out at a pretty good clip, a recession. That's one aspect. During that period, do you realize that at the end of last year and toward the end, at the height of a long recession that grew steadily, widened, we had more people working in America than ever worked before. 92 million people were working. There were less a million. I mean, there were a million less than at the very highest employment at the outset of the slide-off. But here, we lose sight of it because of our proper concern with the 10%. Everybody argues the figure, but taking the yardsticks that's normally used, the 10% unemployed, we've neglected to realize that despite steel being absolutely flat, despite the automobile industry on its face, despite construction, all these great formerly basic bellwether industries, absolutely in turmoil and trouble, including chemical industries, we still had, as I say, 9 out of 10 Americans were working, and there were more Americans working than ever before. So the system isn't a failure at heart. And also, what we've forgotten and what we have only begun to realize is that this has been a transition period. People, what was happening in this country, we've just come to realize it. There's been a great shift from, as we went, say, from the agricultural age to the industrial age. We're now into the age of high tech. It's a whole different thing. So people, they have to be re-employed, re-deployed. Unemployment is less than the figure would indicate. Not if you're one of the figure. You have a different point of view.
Well, you could say that the casualties of this transition from industry to service and information are the people who used to be employed in industry, because a lot of the companies themselves are diversifying and they're recovering fine, but the people who spent their lives working in steel mills and who are 45 now aren't going to be most likely great computer operators next year. It's the training programs don't exist, and the competition is fierce, even in the information industries. And there's a lot of young competition who started out with that training to whom it's already second nature.
Yeah, what you say is valid, but you know, the difficulty for the 45-year-old is not totally. He has a certain advantage. Even though he's lost his job in the assembly line or in the steel plant, and when Detroit's making as many automobiles as they ever did, it will be with a 40 or more less percent of people doing it. But those people, if you spent your life 20 years in Detroit or elsewhere, it's hard to get up and move to where jobs are or to retread. But at 45, you know, you're just approaching middle age. As somebody who's 63 years old, I feel I'm at middle age, not just obviously in the chronology, but just, you know, you have a big advantage. You're seasoned. You're able to learn also. You just have to have hope that the fires of ambition and challenge and excitement of being alive haven't all sort of turned to embers. These people, there are jobs. They're going to be in the forthcoming economy. I just got this list of the kind of people that they don't all have to be computer operators, even though 75% of the jobs in a few years are going to be somewhat related to it. But as you said, it's the information explosion. It's a whole different technology. High tech is the buzzword. But in telemarketing, this is a statistic that's been compiled recently by the year 2000. You know, that's only, what, a dozen years down the road, 15, 16. 8 million people are going to be needed. Software writers, 1 million. Geriatric social workers. You see, it isn't all in learning technology. The jobs, nurses, secretaries, people of what you might call normal skills. Try to hire a secretary now. They're very hard to find. You can advertise till you're blue in the face, and they're very hard to find. Nobody studies shorthand. Nobody studies typewriting anymore. And nurses in geriatric care, most of us are going to live a lot longer thanks to these extraordinary explosions of in terms of genes and biology and biochemistry and so forth. The whole new areas are opening up where it isn't a skill required. It's heart, caring, wanting to work. And these things are going to exist in ever larger quantities in terms of jobs.
I guess that's one of the places that a lot of people would challenge our system the way it is now, because the emphasis now is if you are out of work and you haven't found a job, it's a reflection on your lack of initiative or your lack of enthusiasm or lack of willingness. Whereas a critic would say that it's a function of the system that there are no jobs where you live, that it shouldn't be necessary to travel to a place where there are allegedly jobs, where the jobs have already dried up and there's a high crime problem, as there already is in a lot of the places in the South. Do you think it's like the person's responsibility if they're unemployed and have been unable to find a job, or do you think that there
unemployment
should be more attention paid to individuals who are left jobless because of the changes in the economy
system? Of course. I mean, to suggest that it's a heartless thing, that tough luck, you lost your job, but the whole thing's going to be better for, in general, later on. That is a fact. It is tough luck. But it also doesn't mean that we can create a system whereby they are guaranteed you can live right where you are, you can have everything you had when you were employed, the government will give it to you if there's no job. That is a whole different thing. No country can afford to do that or can't afford to do it and have a free enterprise system. What you get is a rationing of employment. You're told where to work. You're sent where you're needed. We have the mobility here. In Europe, suppose you lose your job in Edinburgh. You've waited 7 years to get an apartment. You can't go down to London and get council housing. There's people waiting there 8 years. We have a mobility here in this country where there is a place to live if you've got a job. You can pick up and go. That it's tough in the interim. That's what I say. We have unemployment compensation. We have other ways of helping. But there, we cannot do it by saying the government will let you stay where you are, live as you did, and you'll have the same income, even though Detroit no longer needs as many people to make cars. All that ensures is there'll be a dwindling standard of living for everybody, and cars will cost twice as much by keeping out the competition, which has been basically the benefit of most Americans, has been the competition for quality that's come from abroad.
I don't want to dwell on this subject much longer, but there are alternatives between the government choosing what job everybody will have and the government not participating in it. There was, for instance, like the WPA program, where people who were at the time unemployed were given the option of working in highway programs and building projects and other programs.
I mean, your point's valid, but you've got to remember when the WPA, the CCC, did extraordinary things. We could use that now in the environment. Every community could use that kind of approach. But WPA and PWA were largely make-work programs. They created an artificiality. Having a highway program, as we're doing now, once again, with the increased gas revenue, that's important. Our infrastructure is falling apart. But basically, in the Depression, one out of four people were unemployed. And those that were employed were, in our company, they got every third week, they called it Scotch Week. My father couldn't pay that week. You worked 3 weeks and got worked four and got paid for three. That was a very different kettle of fish from, not if you're unemployed today, but in terms of numbers, we're talking about one out of 10 instead of one out of four. So there were different and drastic measures called for, and much good came from some of them, such as the CCC. But I don't think the analogy is applicable in today's circumstances.
Malcolm Forbes is my guest, if you're just joining us. He's the chairman and editor-in-chief of Forbes magazine, and he's in Philadelphia to speak this evening at the World Affairs Council. Here in a place like Philadelphia, the issue of corporate responsibility is a major one, and I'm thinking here especially of does the corporation have any responsibility if it's going to be moving its plant? Does it have any responsibility to its employees and to the community that it was in? Should it notify that community, the employees, a long period of time before it moves? Should there be a long period of severance pay for the employees, added periods of health insurance and other benefits to tide people over until there was another job? And I'm thinking especially of industries that have been there or companies that have been there for many, many years where the city basically grew around it and depended on it.
Well, they have a responsibility, but not to the extent that you talked about. In the first place, a company doesn't happily close a plant that long since has been amortized. They don't just pick up and go to be capricious and unkind and unfeeling. They go into, or they die, they have to go into new businesses. They have to go into new fields. They have to go into new technologies. I don't know how many skilled software writer people able to do software there are in Philadelphia. I don't know what the school system's supplying in the way of people able to handle Silicon Valley jobs. But the fact is that a lot of what companies did 50 years ago is not what they're doing today. And they don't close a plant. Normally, they know that it's under consideration, obviously, a couple of years ahead of time. I quite agree they should level sooner rather than announce kerplunk. But very few people in plants aren't aware when the job is in jeopardy because the product isn't selling, when the company's moving. You got to remember what happened in New England. They lost the textile business to the South. They lost the glove business and the shoe business to Europe. They made things better, less expensively, and the bottom fell out of the New England economy. Today it's thriving, but it was a 30-year transition there. We're not going to have that long. It's going much faster here, but a company cannot underwrite, freeze itself into amber and stay soluble. A company's first responsibility is to stay in business because there might be 40,000 jobs involved and they're closing a plant that has 1,200 jobs involved, and you're suggesting that maybe they should assume a long-range responsibility for those people that are no longer, not through any fault of their own, productive. That would saddle a company with a cost that would jeopardize the other. Companies can go broke in this country just as well as make a profit.
But if a company moves to another state that isn't unionized or another country that has no union, say another country where labor is very cheap, do you think of that as being exploitation?
No, no. The fact that, for instance, we lost our television assembly industry. We lost it because people could buy television sets instead of for $1,000 and $1,500. They could buy them for $300. Who benefited from that? Multi-millions of people that could never have had a television set because it could be assembled at less expense in Taiwan or in Mexico. But look what happened in this country in the service industry. Infinitely more jobs are a byproduct of multi-millions of people being able to afford a television set and wanting the tape deck and everything else than those who lost the job on the assembly line. There's never been a point at which making things less and better for the public, as Japanese cars did, they make our own industry get more competitive, more concentrating on quality, and it isn't a matter of callousness and heartlessness that leads to these technological changes. The day we try to freeze everybody where they're at, we're dead as a competitive and thriving and improving standard of living and as a beacon for the world and as a free nation. You cannot have it both ways.
We now have many multinationals that are kind of based in America but have locations all over the
world.
And many of them have moved their major bases to other countries. Industries that former or companies that formerly employed Americans. Do you think that the multinationals are changing the nature of the free enterprise system in America?
Not in any way. One in five jobs, by the most conservative estimates, no matter which side of the spectrum you might be on in terms of your beliefs and convictions, one in five jobs in this country are directly dependent on our export market. You name IBM, we wouldn't be the world leader in computers. We wouldn't have IBM. We wouldn't have the Apples and so forth if they were making a better product and dominating, if you will, the market for these technologies in foreign countries. Every country's after many aspects of our far better technology. But we cannot shut out our markets. For instance, our farmers, wheat, our grains, agricultural exports, paid for a major part of our oil imports. It's a two-way street, and this country would suffer the most if the world returned to the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of the Depression that helped trigger the Depression, where we were going to insulate ourselves in our market and expect to export. There'd be rampant unemployment. People would pay much more for much less. We are part of the world and an important part of the world, and we cannot take a narrow view and say, well, to protect less efficient Detroit automobile operations, we are going to ban Japanese cars or cut them down to 1,000 a year. The only people who would suffer are the American people and the American standard of living by that kind of an approach. It isn't the answer.
But some of these companies are based in countries where unionizing is illegal, if people wanted to unionize for a better wage, they would be punished harshly.
Where?
Oh, and many of the Central American companies there.
Yeah, Central American countries. I mean, you're talking about numbers of no kind. Who's got a major assembly and operation in Central America? I mean, basically, it used to call them banana republics, sugar, cocoa.
Coca-Cola.
They have plants there, but they don't export coke and syrup from Central America to New York or the United States. Sure, they send sugar here, from which they is an important part of it, but those people have to have jobs, too. They have to have a market. And Coca-Cola is a prime example of an export from this country that is international, universal, and loved everywhere, and has grown in this country in jobs, in impact on our economy enormously. Having plants elsewhere, it's just like we not only permit but properly encourage the Japanese to start making things in this country, and they're learning a different system. You see, the implication of your question, that this is a big thing to squeeze the worker, to break the unions. That isn't what breaks unions. What breaks unions is when the companies go out of business, as countless newspapers have, where the union refused to allow new technology because they said it'll cost some of our typesetters' jobs if it's done electronically. Well, as a result, papers couldn't compete with papers where they didn't have that circumstance. The craft unions went through this a couple of hundred years ago, trying to prevent the manufacture, steam engines, and things that did what human labor had to do. This, you won't stop that kind of progress. What you have to do is try to handle the transition better than we do now.
I think labor in a lot of ways is getting a mixed message. On the one hand, we as a country pride ourselves on our standard of living, which is so much higher than many other places in the world. And on the other hand, we see many of our businesses leaving to those countries where the standard of living is much lower so that they could take advantage of the cheap labor.
Who are they and what are they?
I unfortunately would not be able to name you the specific countries and where they left.
My feeling is not to doubt your statement. It's just that's considerably exaggerated. As I explained to you, TV set making, it became sensible to do it where the hand labor involved was less expensive. But as I told you, as I suggested, the byproduct of that, the beneficiary of that, has been millions of people who can buy TV sets and all the peripheral industries that grew up around the fact there's a TV set, at least one, in virtually every home. This couldn't have been affordable if the sets were still costing $1,500 here. It's a two-way street, and a company that is doing right by the customer is doing right by its employees overall.
Did you support the auto industry in their pleas to the American public to buy American?
No. Americans will buy American cars when they're the best thing they can get for the money. Detroit's problems did not originate in Japan. They originated at in the executive suites of Detroit. That's why these fellows get huge salaries, is so because they have the responsibility. And in Detroit, they didn't foresee it. They didn't meet it. They didn't get into pollution. My God, Detroit, the automobile moguls were blaming the oil companies for the gas shortage. I mean, silly stuff. You'd think they would elementarily know better, but they want an excuse. They didn't want to change the way they did business. In Japan, the Japanese and the Germans were simply making a better car. Now Detroit's concentrating on quality, on giving you a better car, on a lighter car, on not on fins and opera windows and vinyl tops and baloney. They're concentrating on doing a better job. Why? Because competition has forced them. And who benefits? All the Americans who drive and buy cars.
Malcolm Forbes is my guest, the editor-in-chief and chairman of Forbes magazine. You had said earlier that you don't think multinationals are really changing our system of enterprise in America.
I think they're benefiting it mostly.
But we're kind of in a more world competitive market, don't you think, than we ever have before with
absolutely.
With
and
the
we've
labor
created,
rates of
we've
different
helped
countries
create
being
the world market. Mm-hmm. And we're the prime beneficiaries of having an open, free trade. There are times when we get the short end of the stick. I'm not painting it as a black and white scene. And you're right. The emphasis on those that get caught in the shift. There are better ways in terms of re-aiming, in terms of education. There are better ways in terms of, as you pointed out, the health insurance. There are iniquities. And there are ways to ease the transition that properly should be done. But the way to do it is not, in effect, to say, let's freeze. Hold it the way it is. Can't be done.
Do you think that consumers and corporations are equal beneficiaries in this world economic system?
They have to be. Otherwise, a corporation can't sell its products. Remember, that's the byproduct of competition. You've got to live up to the competitor. The worst thing that happens is if there's monopoly. And that's the real gut of keeping this system working, is the government being vigorous in the prevention of little gatherings where they agree on a monopoly, they agree on a price. As long as there's somebody out there that can make his buck doing it better, you have to stay in the stick. A corporation's first responsibility is to succeed. And to do that, they've got to stay up or one ahead of the competition, and the beneficiary has to be the consumer.
I think consumers are sometimes a little suspicious, though, knowing that they could save, you know, a couple of dollars on an item with the good going rate, but seeing a corporation getting very wealthy off of that as they save a couple of bucks.
Now, come on. How would they save a couple of bucks? Can you grow and make a breakfast cereal cheaper than you can buy it in a grocery store? Of course not. It isn't that they charge them a couple of bucks more. If Kellogg wasn't making money through distribution, packaging, coming out with new things, if they weren't making a profit, they couldn't employ people. They'd be out of business. They couldn't distribute cereal. If there was one company making cereal or no companies making cereal at a so-called profit, you'd pay. You wouldn't have much cereal except if you grew it or made it or stuck your own wheat in the water or whatever the hell they do to make a cereal. That's almost, you might say, a leftover feeling of the a residue of the Depression and the teaching for two decades that followed, that the villainy was in profit. The villainy, the villain is those who don't operate at a profit.
Two of the really popular shows on TV, I don't know if you watch these or not, are Dynasty and Dallas. And, Dallas, I can say with certainty, is about a oil-owning family, right? Dynasty, I think, is too. What do you think of those images on TV of the, you know, of the boardrooms and a family dynasties?
They're prevalent, and it's much more fun to see, and it makes a great plot villainy. I mean, it's always the big bloated, heartless plutocrat machinating, and his wife home crying, and all the baloney. It's fun. It's soap opera, is what it is. It's hyped, but you know, it's interesting. The depiction of big businessmen. I just saw a piece, and I'm going to use it in my own column in the magazine, that showed how cartoonists depict businessmen. And among the cartoons, it wasn't just what you might call liberal or left-wing thinkers. One of the illustrations was Forbes magazine's own posters and own advertising, where we show the usual fat guy. He's corpulent. He's got a walrus mustache. He just looks like all of us think of, these big fat tycoons. So what I've decided we're going to do, incidentally, in our next issue, I'm going to reprint those, including our own. Everybody depicts, you know, sort of this big fat guy ever since Nast in his day and so forth. It's a way of showing wealth and the tycoon. It's a big blown up cartoon. Actually, I think we're going to get the statistics in the next issue we do on America's 400 richest people. One of the things I'm going to have them find out and research, how much do these guys weigh, and ladies, because there's a lot of ladies in the ranks now. How much do they weigh? I bet you we'll find that on average they're underweight, simply because they can afford not to eat and or go to diet farms and or, exercise, do all the damn things that somebody working who needs the energy and can't watch his diet that way. They can afford to be thin, I'll put it that way. And I'll bet you they're not fat and bloated like all our normal conceptions of them. Our TV does the same thing. You exaggerate to make a point.
I wonder what you think of John Malloy, who has, with his Dress for Success books, made a profession of teaching people how to look as if they're successful corporate heads, so that they can look the part and therefore stand a better chance of getting the part when they're auditioning for a job.
That's like all those things. There's something in it, but also they say clothes don't make the man, but you know, they do often make the woman. The fact is that, or the lack of clothes maybe help in some cases. But the point is that it is true. You form a first quick impression. But no company is going to hire an executive on appearance. You get maybe a scholastic record, or they've come to your attention because they were in the stockroom. The proverbial story is more than ever multiplied and true today in the United States. Most people in this business, for instance, radio and TV, etc., they began with any job, gophers, getting the coffee and whatnot. They get to know people. People recognize, gee, they've got a little spark of personality there. They got something. They make their own opening by being where it's at and knowing what they want to do, and they figure the way to do it. And if clothes help with some person, all right, do it. Play the game, but know what game it is you're playing. It isn't to be phony. It's just simply, okay, they want somebody that looks like a businessman if he's going to be out selling our product, or if we're going to, you know. If that's what's required, fine. If long hair down to their, I had two sons that wore long hair long after it was out of fashion. Why? Because since it was out of fashion, they didn't want to cut it. They just were still, sort of feeling, I'm not going to do what everybody else does. We all want to be individuals. But you have to not phony it up, but you have to modify a little bit. And if you want the job, do what helps to get it. And if it's dressing a certain way, on the other hand, if you're going to be in a boutique and selling trendy clothes, hell, you got to wear the things. You can't go in there looking like a stuffed shirt from a Brooks Brothers window.
You mentioned before that you think one of the things that Forbes finds really important and does a lot of is finding out who the people are behind the steering wheel of
right.
the major corporations. What do you think are the ideal traits for a corporate head to have? What makes a good person at the top of a corporation?
The one who can make it run profitably. And that takes a variety of ingredients depending on the situation. Sometimes, in the case of Detroit, there was a period when salesmen were the best thing they had at the head of the company, somebody that knew how to package and sell. On the other hand, during the war and before and certain times since, a man that knew manufacturing, knew how to crank out the stuff, how to best make the assembly line run, how to best get the new molds into production, to start up a new plant in almost any industry. So sometimes the emphasis were there. Then in recent years, it's been on the accountants and the lawyers, where the big game has been mergers and fighting off mergers, and where legal questions, and they've become more and more important. And often accountants. The last three heads of General Motors have been accountants. It's a variety, and it changes. And the one thing we know, there's never a general statistic. And you've got to remember, any statistic that you can generalize, there are those above it, and there's those under it, and there's nobody at it.
What kind of what do you think that women have penetrated the corporate level that your readership is on? As we stated before, one out of five Forbes readers is a millionaire. I think, a lot of people in the upper echelon of corporations read it. Are there many women on that level yet, do you think?
No, there's more and more, but not many. It's been a slow hoe up to the top. We're past the tokenism stage where everybody put a woman on the board, and the ideal, as they used to satirically say, was a black Jewish woman. This would cover everything in one package. We're away from that baloney. I think we're far beyond tokenism in all these areas. There's a recognition. These are great numbers of enormous capability, but it just takes a while. But thanks to the whole women's lib thing, which got to be absurd in its demands and extreme things, to where, we couldn't talk about manhole covers. There had to be people hole covers. I mean, silly stuff. But aside from the silliness at the one end, we've gotten away from the total blockage at the other end. Both legally you can't do it, and companies are discovering, my God, women are as smart as they were when they had to compete against them in grammar school, and as smart as they are in managing the marriage. They can take those same characteristics. You always joke, you know, that the woman knows how to manipulate the man. But more so, it's more than that. On the home front, they also know how to run a business, and sometimes more capably. There are more and more, but not yet anything like a comparable number.
When I read a magazine, I like to look at the ads and try to guess the psychology of the people taking out the ads, who are the people who seem to know most about who the readers are. And I notice most of the ads in Forbes magazine, when you see a woman in the ad, it's usually a suggestion that the man who's reading the magazine buy this gift for the woman. One of them was an ad with a woman wearing a diamond necklace, and it said, "A rare diamond for that rare individual who never doubted you'd make it." So it's the image of, like, the wealthy woman who is the booster for the man who's finally succeeded.
Yeah, the psychology lingers. And in the case of diamonds, let's face it, despite the promotion efforts, men aren't apt to wear diamond necklaces, and the necklace takes far more diamonds than any other single thing. And the man is apt to, give it to his wife. She's apt to think she also has a lot of residual feeling about diamonds are a girl's best friend type of thinking. And so it works that in the case you cite, the guy is the best medium for selling diamonds. He buys them for his wife to establish, maybe have a guilty conscience, but to establish his success. She's a walking advertisement for him. She's pleased to have something to hang on to in case he slips out or she wants to slip out. She got something to take with her. That specific instance is a little different from the generalities. More and more, you do see women, sometimes in a strained thing. I think those maiden form ads were the biggest current insult, and they were all aimed at women. Were just so stupid that it defied imagination. I'm glad to see the accounts shifting to a new agency, and presumably these ladies won't be showing their bra and panties in industrial and stockbroker offices where they'd stop traffic, but they wouldn't have anything to do with the business and the setting they were talking about. That kind of thing. I think we're also, don't you, getting generally a way to where the depiction more relates to the reality.
Mm-hmm. You are a multi-millionaire. It's been estimated about $200 million. I won't ask you to say how much it really is.
I don't know.
But knowing a lot of wealthy people as you do, is there ever a point where a wealthy person is apt to say, "Well, I've got plenty. It's enough, and I'm gonna stop worrying about money or stop trying to make more from it. I'm gonna kind of forget about those concerns and just enjoy myself or do something different or whatever." Is there ever a point where you say that's enough?
Sure, in one sense, in a limited sense. You see, for me, I don't know what I'm worth. All I know is that I do have more than enough for my normal needs and abnormal needs in the sense of wanting to buy the newest motorcycle of any make that turns me on. I've got a garage full, and all my friends come over and we ride together, and everybody enjoys all the other cyclists that we ride with. They enjoy seeing the newest bike, etc. It doesn't create an envy. It's an indulgence, but it's not done just to have numbers. It's just done because I can afford it. It's fun. Everybody else enjoys it, probably not as much as I do, but I can, you know, keep up with the state of the art and all that. But basically, somebody has to love what they're doing to become wealthy at doing it. And their joy is not in the money that's the byproduct. It's a very valuable and happy one. But it's the fun of doing it. I could stop working, but my God, I'd be miserable. I don't find it work. I love to sit down at my desk and write editorials. I love to go over what's in the magazine. I enjoy knowing, not the people per se, but I find it challenging to try to measure. We have 2 or 3 days a week, we have the new heads of corporations that we don't know. They come to lunch, they sit down with me, my sons, our editors, and we're evaluating them, and we're talking in a way that you can't do when it's just an interview across a desk for an article. Then everybody's on guard. But you're trying to measure the man, and these are all off the record. We guarantee that. We don't abuse it. But we're trying to get the feel of this fellow. And it isn't that I wouldn't know what to do with myself. I just love what I'm doing, and I think that has to be true. You have to like what you're doing, or your program wouldn't be what it is. Your own feeling comes through. When I told people I was going to be on it, I'm not saying this to be flattering. I told you that earlier. They said, "Oh, she's good." Well, you're good because you like what you're doing. And I dare say if you were paid 10 times as much, you wouldn't want to quit the program. And that's generally true. It isn't to make the more, which is a wonderful byproduct, as I say, but it's not the accumulation. It's the fun of doing what you do, and if you're successful, the company gets bigger. I mean, we employ five times probably as many people as we did 10 years ago. But other people benefit when what you're doing, you're successful at. And that isn't why you do it, but it's as important and bigger as more people benefit than just you.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. It's really been interesting to have you here, and thanks for doing the interview. Thanks for being here.
That's been great fun for me.
Malcolm Forbes has been my guest, and he's the chairman and editor-in-chief of Forbes magazine. And he's in Philadelphia to speak this evening at the World Affairs Council. And if you're interested in attending that program, let me give you some more information. It will begin at 6 o'clock this evening at the Bellevue Stratford. And for more information, you can call the World Affairs Council there at 563-5363. That's 563-5363. I want to mention that if you're interested in financial matters, that we'll be having as a guest next Tuesday at 3 o'clock Neil Kaufman, who now writes a column on financial matters for the City Paper and for the New Philadelphia Business Paper. And his specialty is investments for people and special savings plans and stuff for people who only have a little money to invest. So that's next Tuesday at 3 o'clock. Well, this week is a busy week at the National Press Club. This Friday, we'll be broadcasting a talk at the National Press Club. And yesterday, we had a talk at the National Press Club. Coming up, we're going to feature a press club appearance by Jesse Jackson, the civil rights leader, who spoke earlier today at the press club on the subject of the viability of a black presidential candidate. This press club appearance happened earlier today. We're going to hear it tape delayed from National Public Radio.
Support for this program is provided by the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Communications Workers of America, representing 650,000 members nationwide in telecommunications and other fields, the John and Mary R. Markle Foundation, and RKO General, a radio and television broadcasting company. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.
From Washington, D.C., National Public Radio presents another in the continuing series of broadcasts from the National Press Club. I'm Frank Stacio. Today's guest speaker is the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who will talk about the viability of a black presidential candidate.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Don Berner. I'm president of the club, associate editor of Traffic World magazine, and columnist for the Frederick News Post. Our speaker today, the Reverend Jesse Lewis Jackson, is uniquely qualified to discuss questions concerning the role of the black voter in the coming